he's come to a place where he could be in contact with the Supreme Divine Mother. And in this canto, which is called The Vision and the Boon, at the beginning, she comes to him, she envelops him, enters deep into him. So we read through the whole canto, then we went back to the beginning to look at the sentences, and I think we read up to line 35. Now the mother is going to speak to Asvapati. Norman, you would start?
A shape was seen on threshold mine, a voice absolute and wise in the heart's chambers spoke. O son of strength who climbs creation's peaks, no soul is thy companion in the light. Alone thou standest at the eternal doors. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. A spirit aspiring in an ignorant frame, a voice arisen from the inconscience world, how shalt thou speak for men whose hearts are dumb? Make pure blind the soul's seer visions open, or lighten the burden of the senseless globe.
Thank you. We started from line 35 on page 335, and Norman just read the first words of the mother to Asvapati. He sees her shape, it says, on threshold mind. The threshold is the door sill that we pass over when we pass from one space to another, into entering the house. Or please take a book, sir. So he sees her shape as if just on the edge of mind, and he hears her voice speaking in his heart, absolute and wise. She calls him son of strength. I remember the mother speaking about there being two lines of avatars. There are the ones who are in the line of consciousness, and there's the ones who are in the lines of power and dynamic action. So here, this what the mother calls Asvapati, she calls him son of strength. He's in the line of shakti, of action, of dynamism, of force. And she says, you have climbed right up to the highest levels of creation. You are all alone. No soul is your companion in the light. You are standing all alone at these eternal doors on the the entrance to the beyond manifestation, the transcendent plane. And she tells him, whatever you have won with your tapasya, with your journey, all that you have learned, all that you have become, that is yours. Nobody can take it away from you. But, she says, but please don't ask anything more. She knows that he has something that he wants to ask for, and of course she knows very well what it is. But she says, don't ask. And then she tells him why. She says, you are a spirit, a free, highly developed spirit, but you are living in an ignorant frame, a material body. You are a voice, you are coming with your prayer, your powerful prayer to me, but you have risen up out of the inconscience world, the evolving, the world that has evolved out of matter. She says, how can you speak? How can you speak on behalf of all those other human beings whose hearts are dumb? They are not asking for anything. They are not aspiring. They are not praying. And earth, the earth that you have come from and that you are representing, is purblind. The word blind is familiar to us, no? And purblind means utterly blind, completely blind, no? Perhaps it even means obstinately blind, that it doesn't want to see. How can you make that earth the home of the seer vision of the soul? She knows that he's going to ask her for earth and men to give full consciousness, full light, full knowledge, full power, no? But she says the men, their hearts are dumb and the earth is purblind. How can you speak for them? How can you lighten the burden of the senseless globe? It means the material globe in which most of it is not even alive. It doesn't have senses, let alone sense, common sense, reason. So that is her first response to him. And over the next two or three pages, she's going to elaborate on that first answer and tell him why this is her response. Sergei?
I am the minister beyond the reach of mind. I am the goal for the...
So this is not very difficult to understand. No? It's quite clear. Anybody wants to ask anything?
What is the travail of the sons?
The travail of the sons. We think of evolution as happening only here on Earth. But actually the whole universe is involved in this evolutionary process. This universe is full of suns, great burning lights, and some of them must have solar systems and planets. So the whole universe, with all its vastness and all the suns that are in it, they are all laboring to give birth to something. And she says, I am the goal. I am the fulfillment for which all this whole universe is laboring, struggling. Is it clear? Travail, particularly, it means this the labor of giving birth.
My danger, my job.
Yes, she's dangerous. She's dangerous to imperfection. No?
But immense joy.
And immense joy, too. Yes.
And
I think when he puts these two words together, it suggests that even in time, there's something that's reluctant and resisting and not ready to accept the full manifestation of the mother. Basically, she's saying it's not time yet. Yes, I suppose if he really spoke the secret name, that would summon her, she would have to come. I don't know what that secret name is, but the name of power that would compel her. And maybe she's even saying, don't even tell people about me, because they are not ready.
Hew.
This means cutting with a great deal of effort. If you're passing through the jungle, you have a big knife and you have to hew your way. Or it's the verb that we use for a sculptor roughly cutting the stone. Later on he will chisel and polish, but first he has to hew it. And Sri Aurobindo in a letter said that Savitri has come to hew the ways of immortality, to make clear a path through a lot of resistance. So that's what the mother is doing, the single power, the all-seeing power, the supreme wisdom is hewing its way, cutting its way through all the resistances of the inconscience of matter and in life, all the falsehood, everything that resists, that is not open to her coming.
So that she said, truth born too soon, but truth was here always the orientation in all the efforts to get, right?
Yes. But the mother has spoken about this, no? There's an evolution going on. You know, it's been deliberately chosen, this idea of starting from the complete inconscience and a gradual unfolding. So if she said it about her own body also, no? On the highest levels of her consciousness, she was in touch with the supermind and all that. But she said it can't just come down like that. It will shatter the way the earth is at the moment. So that is why things have to go more gradually and slowly.
Why the mother doesn't want to have the earth here? While we know that Mother is sent to help,
yes. Yes, I think you just have to be a little bit patient, because this is exactly the contradiction that's going to be worked out in this canto. But she hints at it here, no? She says, please, you go on helping the world. And later on she says, my force will be with you. We will be doing it together. We will be preparing the world. But now you are coming with your burning aspiration, and you are going to ask me to send all my power and bliss and everything to earth. And please don't ask me that. Because the earth is not ready. Yeah.
The reference to thy grace lonely day while helping the earth, is that because he's different to other men, or because of the piece of him that's still inconscient?
It's because he is all alone. She says, you are all alone at the eternal doors. You're the only one who has achieved all this. So other people have to also come up before it will be time. But you can help them. You go back to earth, go on spreading all the light and consciousness and force that you have gained. You will help in the preparation. Yeah. Yes, that only you have gained, yes. Yeah. Shall we move on? Yeah, Don?
I ask thee not to merge thy heart of flame in the immobile's wide, uncaring bliss. Turn from the fruitless motion of the years, deserting the fierce labor of the world, aloof from beings, lost in thee alone. How shall thy mighty spirit brook repose while death is still unconquered on the earth, and time a field of suffering and pain? Thy soul was born to share the laden force. Obey thy nature and fulfill thy faith. Accept the difficulty and accept the difficulty and godlike toil. For the slow-paced, omniscient purpose live.
Thank you. The goal of many yogas is to merge with the Supreme. And he has shown that he can do that. He has realized the Purushottama. I cannot say that he's realized it, but he's experienced the Purushottama consciousness. He knows this. So she says, I'm not asking you to merge, to leave the world and melt back into the immobile's wide, uncaring bliss. No? That is possible. The soul can choose to do that, to merge back into the immobile consciousness beyond the manifestation. But you have a heart of flame that's full of aspiration and energy. So I'm not asking you to merge. I'm not asking you to turn away from the motion of the years, the slow passage of time. It may seem to be fruitless, may seem as if it is in vain. But nevertheless, I'm not asking you to do that. No? I'm not asking you to desert, to abandon all the fierce labor of the worlds, that travail of the suns, all that effort which is going on in the moving universe. I'm not asking you to remove yourself to a distance, aloof from beings, lost in the alone, the one supreme, unmanifest existence. She says, how will you be able to do it? You are such a mighty spirit. No? How will you be able to bear rest? To brook means to accept or suffer. There's these lovely words of Jesus. No? He says, suffer the little children to come unto me. No? The people wanted to shoo them away. He said, no, let them come. So, how will your mighty spirit allow you to rest while death is still unconquered on the earth and time is a field of suffering and pain? You won't be able to do it. I'm not asking you to do that. She says, your soul was born to share the laden force. If something is laden, it is carrying a load. It's the bullock carts, sometimes they are so heavily laden, they have such heavy loads to carry. So the great creative force, the mother's own force, is laden. And your soul was born to share that load. You are a son of strength. So obey your nature. Fulfill your fate. Return to earth. Accept all the difficulty, all this God-like toil, this enormous effort which it requires a divine strength to do. Live, go on living for the slow-paced, omniscient purpose. The supreme wisdom, the all knowledge, has a purpose, an intention. There's a purpose in this whole creation. Go back to earth and live for that purpose. And now she's going to explain to him about the role of human beings. Very important for us to understand what comes next. Bela.
The enigmas know is carried in humankind, arriving from the fact that things and land, clogging the air of life with vanishing threads. Man, soul awake in an unconscious world, aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. Arrived from some half-luminous beyond, he's a stranger in the mindless past, a traveler in his oft-shifting home, amid the threat of many infinities. He has pitched a tent of life in desert space. Heaven's fixed regard beholds him from above, in the house of nature, perturbing guests, Voyager, fixed thoughts in constant shores, a hunter of unknown and beautiful powers, a nomad of the far mysterious light, in the wide ways a little spark of love.
The enigma's knot is tied in humankind. There's a mystery, a very complicated puzzle. that we can see if we look at the universe around us and we wonder, where has all this come from? And does it have any purpose? And if so, what is that purpose? So here Sri Aurobindo is saying somehow that the key to that enigma, that riddle or mystery of life, it is in the human race, in human beings. And that's where it can be solved. Whenever he uses this word knot, we can't help thinking of the Gordian knot. It's a story connected with Alexander the Great, that when he set out on his program of conquest, he was told that there's this knot somewhere, and that only somebody who unties the knot will be able to rule the whole earth. But he was an impatient young man, and he had great confidence in his own power, so he took out his sword and he cut the knot. And Sri Aurobindo repeatedly tells us that this is not the solution. Cutting the knot is not the solution. The knot has to be understood. It has to be untied. And then that person will be able, or whoever does that, will be able to be a ruler, a true ruler. It was the place. So that's the first thing he's saying, that humanity is the knot that has to be untied, or is holding the knot that has to be untied. And then she speaks about man. There are several places in Savitri where Sri Aurobindo explains about man. Now, this is one of them. She calls man, humanity, a lightning from the heights that think and plan. Man, the mental being, has come into the manifestation like a flash of lightning, coming from not the supreme heights, but the mental plane, where thinking and planning goes on. He comes into the evolved world of life, and he, with his think thoughts, and he plans. He, like a farmer, he plows, but he doesn't plow the ground. He plows the air, the mental atmosphere, with vanishing trails. So the furrows that he makes fade away, like we see the trails behind the aeroplanes fading away in the air. There's nothing really permanent in the thought world. But nevertheless, man, humanity, is the only fully conscious species, or it's not half conscious species. It's awake. Man alone is awake in this unconscious world. But although he's awake and aware of the imperfections of the world as it is, he does not have the power to change the cosmic dream. He aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. She says that man, he, all of us, have come here from some half-luminous beyond, from the mental plane. And here in our minds we are strangers in all the mindless vasts of the universe. We are travelers, like Asvapati was a traveler, in his oft-shifting home. Not quite sure what Sri Aurobindo means by this line. could be that he means only that we move from one body to another. But I've seen a passage in now it must be published in the record of yoga, I suppose, a text that he wrote and didn't publish in his lifetime, where he speaks about humanity having come here from another planet and maybe going to be moving on to another planet. And he mentions Mars, but from the way that his sentence is constructed, you can't tell whether he means that Mars was the place we came from or it's the place we might be going to. It's interesting. And as I say, he never published it in his lifetime, so we don't know the significance of this, whether it was some knowledge that was channeled to him or something like that. But anyway, here we are, travelers in our oft-shifting home, amid the tread of many infinities in this vast universe that we are really not aware of.
To this point, I did a spiritual traveling to Crete with Master Hilarion. They told us that there had been 12 people from different planes born there. So that is that seems that the souls coming on Earth are, born on other planes.
Representing other planes, yes. So humanity as a whole is the mental being. So we are representing the mental planes. Of course, there are many different mental planes. Here, humanity has come and pitched a tent of life in desert space on our Earth, our beautiful Earth. Here, there's the possibility of life, and mind has entered into it. And it seems in the very early times, I think they're finding out more and more about it now. It's not only that when man came into the earth, it was like a paradise. Mother has spoken about that, how the beings who came were in such a state of harmony with the nature, the first mental beings. But even much more recently, people that we used to think of that they were just savages and nomadic hunter-gatherers and so on, they were doing things to foster the environment, to plant forests and take care of everything so that Earth became very, very fruitful for them. And now we have forgotten all about that. Of course, it was easier then when the population was not so great. So here we are, we've pitched this tent, not a permanent home. It's the home of a nomad, no? Who shifts his home a lot. Space is desert, but here there's an area of life. Heaven, the higher levels of consciousness, including the mental planes, are watching man. And here, in the house of nature, he's a perturbing guest. He disturbs things. He stirs things up. He's a hunter. Asvapati is a hunter of unknown and beautiful powers, where something in us makes us always hunt for greater things. And we are nomads. First we are nomads on the earth. Eventually we become nomads moving in search of the far mysterious light. Sorry, where are you reading? A nomad of the far mysterious light. Yes. Well, what is mysterious is a mystery, no? Yes. So that light that we are hunting after Actually, we don't know very well what it is or why we are hunting after it, but it's a light and it's attracting us, even though it is very far away. And because it's mysterious to us, we may sometimes follow misleading lights. We think, oh, that is the light I have to follow. And we follow after it, but then we find out, oh no, that wasn't the right light. The real light that I'm seeking is somewhere else. And that's why we are nomads, we are wandering.
That's why we pitch tents,
exactly. So in the wide ways of the universe, humanity is carrying this little spark, tiny little spark of God. It's a kind of representative of the divine in the universe, in the material universe.
Line aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. So it means there is a cosmic dream, but humankind likes to change it.
We would like to change it because we think the way that things are not good enough. No? But we don't have the power to change it. We have the consciousness to see that things are imperfect and they should be better. But we don't. The mental power is not enough to achieve that. That's why we have to attain some higher level of consciousness. That's what Sri Aurobindo is always telling us, no? Okay, we do our best and we have to do our best. The cosmic dream can only be changed on a higher level of consciousness, only when we can reach that. It's okay.
In those two, Shravan, meet the tree of many infinity.
Yes.
Many infinity is on many levels.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know whether this word. Oh, he says infinities. Yes. Mm. So there isn't only one infinity. There are lots and lots and lots of infinities. I think that even mathematicians have decided that this must be the case.
Yeah, they speak about multiverse.
That's the cosmologists now. They've decided there must be more than. Seems logical that there will not be only one universe, but many. And in the field of mathematics, of course, infinity is a very important concept in mathematics. And I think, what's the name of the man? Cantor? Who's being an important modern mathematician. He introduced the ideas that there can be different dimensions on which they are all infinite. No? A voyager, man is a voyager between thought's inconstant shores. So a voyager is a traveller, particularly a sailor. Mm? And a sailor sets off from one shore and maybe reaches another one. The shores of thought, we travel in mental space, with our thoughts we travel. And those shores are inconstant, they're always shifting, you know. Certain ideas get established and we think, oh, that's a firm land, that's a continent. But you may, when you get there, you may find that the shore has shifted. It's not where you thought it was. And when we reach one shore, we will go off to another one. Something like that.
And the space in between is very insecure.
And the space in between is very insecure. It's okay. Shall we move on, Marie-Ange?
against its spirit or its entire league. Titan influence stops.
In league, they are allied, or they formed a kind of conspiracy. Mm. Hmm? So he says all different kinds of things, no, are in league to prevent man from looking towards God.
Think of the League of Nations.
The League of Nations, yeah. And then he lists the things that are in league against the spirit of man turning towards his divine source. The void is the emptiness, which seems to want to swallow us up in material space. The physicists tell us it's ruled by the law of entropy, by which everything becomes less gets. So the ancient rishis spoke about the material universe as being the eater eaten. No, the eater eating is eaten. The whole play of the material universe is this emptiness swallowing, endlessly eating and being eaten. Something like that. So that's what's happening around us. And there's this Titan superhuman influence preventing us to look towards God. Eternal darkness. This is what we feel about death, no? That we are our little beings are just going to get eaten up by the pitiless void, and we are going to be swallowed by the darkness. And then there are inscrutable energies. There are forces that are so mysterious. If something is inscrutable, it has a face that you can't read, you can't understand. It comes scrutiny. No, you can look at something and discern it. If it's inscrutable, you can't see what it is behind, what is behind it. No, here this is on the vital level, the inscrutable energies, no, that are driving us and deceiving us. These are the energies that lead us into error and falsehood. And there are very powerful deities, implacable, ruthless, tyrannical deities that oppose man.
What might those deities be?
I think again these are vital godheads, as we read about them in Canto 7 and 8 and elsewhere. And then he again refers to something we read about in the previous canto, that our world as we see it now seems to be ruled by and to have been created by an inert soul and a somnambulist force. Always these two go together, the consciousness of the supreme existence and the dynamic force. But in this evolutionary universe, it seems to have started from a soul that doesn't move and a force which is asleep, working in her sleep. So this is the effect of the involution into unconsciousness, to the inconscient. So this inert, unmoving soul, the Lord is there, but he doesn't take any interest. The force is just doing her work in her sleep. She's doing it amazingly well in her sleep, but still. Together, they have created this material world that is estranged from life and thought. So that makes it very difficult for the mental being to be dominated by this material world. No? And here in the material world, the dragon of the dark foundation. This is the dragon of the inconscient. It keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. That everything that is born must die, and that things may seem to be fixed, but there's always the play of chance, which is often hostile. That's the basis of our universe, protected by this dragon of the dark foundations. And as we human beings travel on our journey, our long evolutionary way, passing through time, through the play of circumstances that we have no control over, he meets the Sphinx, the grey-hued, riddling, nether shadow Sphinx. I think Sri Aurobindo mentions the Sphinx 4 times in the poem, and each time it's a different aspect of the Sphinx. But the essential characteristic of the Sphinx is that she poses you the existential questions that you have to be able to answer, otherwise she destroys you. But if you know, can find the answer, you slay her, you conquer her, or she has to serve you. So here he's speaking about the Sphinx on the lowest levels, the lower levels, the shadow Sphinx. She's grey, and she meets you with her riddle, with her question. And he images her like the Egyptian Sphinx, who is actually different from the Greek Sphinx, who asks the riddle. But here he puts them together. And there she is, her dreadful paws upon the swallowing sands. She's waiting for him, and she's got the word that can slay his soul, actually, not just his physical body, but his soul. And whichever way he goes, across his path sits the dim camp of night. I once did a little study about Sri Aurobindo's use of the word night in Savitri. There are a certain number of usages, and some of them are used in the way that we usually use the word night, you know, when the sun is below the horizon and it's dark and we sleep. But more often he uses it in the sense of the inconscient, the darkness of unconsciousness or inconscience. And in a very few places he uses it
in the sense of the night of falsehood. That is, deliberately, consciously resisting the light. So here it must have one or two of these two symbolic meanings, or perhaps both of them together. The night of falsehood is born out of the night of ignorance. Yes, Ganga Lakshmi.
I have a question about the dragon of the Dark Foundation Keep. You know, Mother, when Mother in 1962 touched with the supramental level, he put light in the unconscious. That is illusion, so many things is illusion, only love and love and love. And this light, the dragon, Aswatati touched the dark of this foundation.
There's one reference to Aswapati in relation to the dragon, which I was looking at recently. That's in Canto 5 of Book 1, where he conceives this great will and the hope, and he looks for the superhuman form, and he, in a great movement of aspiration, he leaves the earth state. He takes off like a rocket. And then Sri Aurobindo says that as a result of that great upward movement, the dragon, the inconscient, lashes its dragon tail. It moves like this. And he says it lashes things into the deep obscurities of form. It's an amazing line, and I don't know what it means. It is of form. So, when it moves its tail. No? But there are other places where he speaks about this dragon, that it's there in the cave. Usually that's where dragons live, no? And usually they are guarding treasures of all kinds, wonderful jewels. So this dragon of the dark foundations, he's there in the cave of the inconscient, and he's guarding a lot of treasures.
Keeps.
He's keeping. Here he's keeping the foundations, and he's keeping the law of, he's keeping the unalterable, the law of death and chance. He's protecting those things. But he's also protecting all kinds of psychological treasures which would help us in the evolution. They are there under the paws of the dragon, and they have to be rescued.
This is just for information. This dragon is the European dragon, European mythical dragon, keeping living in the cave and keeping treasures. There is the Oriental, the Chinese dragon, which I won't go into, but it's a creature of wonderful...
Well, he's a benevolent dragon.
He's a benevolent dragon.
But he keeps treasures. He lives, one of the dragons lives under the sea, and he keeps the treasures there. So I think they're the same dragon, it's just a different way of looking at them. There's the dark, terrifying monster that is there in Western,
and
St. George has to kill the dragon. But there's also this Eastern dragon who you can make friends with him, and then he will share his treasures with you. But this dark dragon of the foundations comes from the Vedas. This is the Vedic image. I, at least Vladimir told me that. I'm not a Vedic expert myself.
But in the Veda, he has a name, Dragon.
Sorry?
He has a name of him.
His name is just Dragon.
Dragon.
I can tell you the Japanese name, but...
Sergei?
Well, this dragon is some kind of energy.
Yes.
Well, it's energy.
Sometimes he seems to be close to the python. You know, we several times came across the python, which seems to be the force that rules. You know, python is constricting, it's holding in its coils the material world.
Again, going back to the Orient, the beautiful phoenix and beautiful dragon are seen together very, very, very often. And the phoenix is female and the dragon is male. Then they are together. Sometimes intertwining, sometimes fighting.
So it's very, very interesting, all these symbolic creatures, and we should take them seriously and try to delve into the depths of their symbolism. And it's different in different cultures, of course. Yeah. So, but you get the idea, that against his spirit, against the spirit of man, everything is in dire league. There's the inconscient with the dragon of the dark foundation. There are these implacable deities and energies on the vital level. And there's the vastnesses, the titan and the void, the emptiness and the eternal darkness. So all these things human beings have to face.
But the dragon is something that can be traditionally overcome.
Certain dragons can be overcome. Whether this dragon can be overcome or not, I don't know. Probably it should be. No? Yeah. But man doesn't have, the mental being is not able to change the cosmic dream. But she's only just started on her explanation about the enigma and the importance of the human being in that.
I'm so sorry, I have to make one more mention of the oriental dragon. If you go to temples, some in China and some in Japan, you purify yourself, you rinse your face, your hands and everything. And the water comes from a spring. And it comes out of the
mouth of the dragon.
He's your friend. He's purifying.
Yeah.
There's that line about the mother, she alone can change time's dragon face.
That's right, that's what it says, yes.
She alone can change time's dragon face.
When we read about the Supreme Divine Mother, part of the description said, alone her hands can change time's dragon base. She's the one who can do it. And somewhere else he speaks of our world, the world that we know, our mental world, as being a golden dome on a black dragon base. She's done a couple of paintings of dragons. One is a vital dragon, but one is this one of the black dragon base with the golden dome on its back. Yes. Shall we go a little further? Rosa, you will read.
His day is a moment in perpetual time. He is the prey of the minutes and the house. A sailor on the earth and unutterable of heaven descends here unhappy and sublime. A link between the demigod and the beast, he knows not his own greatness nor his aim. He has forgotten why he has come and went. His spirit and his members are at war. His heights. The brick of too low to reach the sky. His Math is based in the animal mind.
So our day is just a moment, the time when we are awake in one lifetime. It's just a moment in perpetual time. Time is not eternal, but it's perpetual, or it's eternal by perpetuity. He's the prey of the minutes and the hours. They eat us up. Here he's attacked, assailed. Everything is in dire league against us. We are attacked on earth, and we are not sure that we will ever be able to reach heaven, unassured of heaven. Man has descended here from his mental plane, unhappy. He's unhappy here. But at the same time, he's sublime, because he's so heroic to have accepted this challenge, this task. Savitri later on, she says, earth is the chosen place of heroic souls. And there are people who have had near-death experiences and seen from some other plane the way things are here on earth. And several of them have said, every single soul on earth is a hero. To have accepted this state. Sometimes I can really see that.
Pliny?
Please speak loud so we can.
Plenty of lessons, and I thought of this. Always be kind, because everyone you meet is fighting a great battle.
Something like that. Yes. Yes, it would help us if we remembered that. So we are also links between the demigod, the half divine being, and the beast, the animal. We have an animal body and we have semi-divine capacities. The thing is that we don't know our own greatness. We don't know what our aim is, because we have forgotten. We have come here, we've accepted to come here, this great challenge, but we've forgotten why he has come. And whence, from where we have come. So there's always this battle going on between our spirit and our members, our physical body. And we can attain certain heights, but we can't reach high enough, we can't reach the skies, we can't reach the heavens of divine mind, and most of us is buried in the animal mire. Mire is dirty mud. The animal, the lower nature, animal nature, which in animals is fine, but in human beings it becomes mire. It's dirty mud. Patty, you'll read a little further.
A strange antinomy is this nature's wound. A riddle of opposites is made his theme. Freedom he asks, but needs to live in bonds. He has need of darkness to receive some light, and need of grief to feel a little bliss. He has need of death to find a greater light. all sides he sees and turns to every call. He has no certain light by which to walk. His life is a blind man's buff, a hide and seek. He seeks himself, and from himself he runs. Meeting himself, he thinks it other than he.
So cute.
Always he builds, but finds no constant ground. Always he journeys, but nowhere arrives. He would guide the world, himself he cannot guide. He would save his soul, his life he cannot save.
Thank you. Everybody knows what an antinomy is?
Contraries.
Contraries.
It means ruled by opposing laws.
Yeah.
So there's one law, set of laws for our spirit and another set of laws for our body. So that's the ruling, the nature's rule for man is somehow contradictory. Is a children's game where one person is blindfolded and all the other children are around him and they try to touch him and he tries to catch them. And if he's caught them, then he has to try to identify who it is. If he can identify which child he's caught, then that child becomes the blind man. And this buff, it's the, you know, touching. So yes, we get hold of things, but we don't know who it is nor what it is because we're blind. And actually it's all ourselves.
So it makes our laugh, us laugh, because it is so true.
Yes. Yes. Shall we stop there for today? Yeah?
It's a great day.
We can hear Mother reading some of these lines.
an influence had approached the mortal range. A boundless heart was near his longing heart, a mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. Face appeared and looked